Hello, Internet. This is David Rovics, and we are broadcasting as usual at most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, interviewing people of interest. And it's this going on out on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, and probably somewhere else that I'm forgetting. And we are going out as a podcast afterwards. If you look for This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts, it'll be there in audio form. And today I'm very happy to be spending the hour with an amazing singer-songwriter, author, recording artist, and somebody I met quite a long time ago now, Frank Turner.
Hello.
Are you here, Frank?
It is. I was saying this just before we went live, but it is such a pleasure to see you. It's been a while, and yes. I'm excited to chat with you, man.
It's a real pleasure, and it's been such a pleasure. Like I've been preparing for this interview for weeks, which is and doing things I should have gotten around to doing a long time ago. listening to some really great music and reading a fascinating book, and I've never. You know, I think most songwriters have thought about writing a book about songwriting and just didn't do it because figuring there's probably too limited an audience. But I don't know, but I'm so glad you wrote that book because it's fascinating. Oh, I don't know how many people are, if it made the bestseller lists or anything, I'd be really surprised. But
It did briefly, but it's a funny old thing. Like because that was my second book. And with both the books I've done, I slightly kind of like, punked the publishing world because of the nature of my audience. So it goes in the bestseller list because everyone who's ever going to buys it in the first week. And therefore it goes bang and the publishing world goes, who the hell is this guy? And then it disappears completely and is never heard of again. So, but it means you get to put bestseller on your CV, which makes me feel terrible.
Which is good. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's important to feel terribly important, as you know. Frank, you know, with the whole pandemic experience and it being sort of starting out with as a person in a room with a guitar and then kind of ending up as a person in a room with a guitar, did you have a bit of that kind of experience of this suddenly life stopped and suddenly you're not touring? I mean, you were a serious road rat for a very long time, and then
and intend to be again as and when I'm allowed. I mean, I never fell out of love with the road. Actually, funnily enough, like in the way that you do toying with sort of ideas idly in your spare time, for many years, I sort of toyed with the idea of taking a year off the road to, you know, go and live in Paris and work in a bar or something. Do you know what I mean? Just to kind of, and I'm now promised to never say that ever again. Like I promise I will never say anything so ridiculous. I was on tour when the pandemic sort of kicked in here in the UK and I had to cancel shows and come home. And that was rough. I was on tour with my friend Micah Schnabel, who's a songwriter from Columbus, Ohio, who's, if you're not familiar with his work, one of my very favorite songwriters ever. Mm. And indeed my wife, who is also a songwriter. So we were having a lovely time and had to come home. But it's interesting you put it like that, because one of the things that I did think was interesting and cool about the last year of performing online to my laptop, which obviously in most ways is kind of dreadful, but there was something quite sort of, there was sort of purifying fire about it to a degree. Mm. You know, I've always tried to run what I do centered around a spine, as it were, of just one person and an instrument. And of course, you know, I play with a band and I've played with string sections and indeed we've had pyrotechnics and we've had sound systems and we've had all of this kind of nonsense. But I've always sort of believed that at the core of it, there was still just me and my guitar. And it was kind of interesting and almost reassuring, I want to say, to go back to that and for it to still be effective. Or at least in my opinion, I mean, people may disagree, but like, you know, and indeed there were musicians who I think struggled with it. It was like, well, how am I supposed to do this without my crew and my tour manager and all the rest of it? And it's just like, well, if you can't do it without those people, what the fuck are you doing? I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions, but like there was something kind of reassuring about that. It was like, yes, I can still do this. There is still something at the heart of this. And this is now opening an enormous can of worms, but to the extent that I am a folk musician, which is in life, I picked the two most charged words that there are in music, punk and folk.
And punk, and then combine them. Yeah, that's fantastic.
I know. Yeah. What an idiot. But to the extent that is in my musical kind of DNA, for want of a better term, I feel like the last year's kind of proved that to a degree. Do you know what I mean? I can just sit down. And I always, and most of my songs are in standard tuning just because I always had this idea that if I got kidnapped by aliens and then dropped anywhere in the world, if you could find a six string guitar in standard tuning, I could do you a show. You know what I mean? And that has, I didn't get kidnapped by aliens, but like it, there was a pandemic, which is arguably as absurd.
Yeah, that I'd give a good argument for trying a drop D, but it's you do amazing things with that with standard tuning.
I've played with Dadgad, but I have a certain type of song that I write in Dadgad because there's certain types of chords you play in Dadgad.
Definitely.
But I'm aware you use a lot more open tunings than I do. I'm aware of this.
I'm a big
fan. Something that I haven't said recently enough is that I do listen to your music often, my friend, and I have many favorites, and they have remained inspirational to me over the years since we first met.
Thank you. And
there we go.
You know that actually just everything you've just said reminds me of several different questions I wanted to ask, but I mean one of the things that really strikes me reading your book as well as listening to your many different recordings is like one of the things you talk about with playing in the band my distinct impression is that the thing you love most about playing with other musicians is that you get to so much more leeway to create what you want to create. And just having that, like, I mean, what people would paint as, success in the music business what it's given you is the opportunity to basically have bigger budgets for recordings and spend more time on things. And
yeah, sure.
And that's, is a fair enough assessment?
Yeah, I think so. But I mean, I guess that like I feel fortunate in my life to have had the opportunity to try many different methodologies and many different things. And indeed, I think without wanting to get too kind of like gooey, philosophical this early on an interview, but it's like life is about trying different things, you know what I mean? And like my early recordings were made on a shoestring budget and recorded in people's bedrooms and that kind of thing, and that was great and I loved it and I had a fantastic time. And when it got to the point of making it, you know, a record with a big producer and a big studio, part of the thinking for me was just like, well, I've never tried it before, so why not try it? Why go through life denying yourself these opportunities? And I can always go back to making shoestring budget records if I need to or if I want to. That it's not, that avenue is not closed off, but the opportunity to do more things is interesting to me because who knows, and our time and light on this planet is short and blah 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 blah. But you know, so and I mean, being in a band, I have my band, I have the Sleeping Souls, they're incredible musicians, and it's just nice to play with other people. That interaction of collectivity is cool. There's just more, there's a wider sonic palette to choose from. When you want a bit to be heavy, it's not just you hitting a guitar harder. Do you know what I mean? There can be somebody also hitting other things. And that's kind of cool. But then like literally just the other day, I did a show with my friend Emily Barker, who's an amazing Australian folk singer who lives in the UK. And we did a show and it was the two of us with like an upright bass and piano and then a string section. And it was all kind of new. And it was, this is going to sound strange perhaps, but like it was a rare moment for me of feeling like a musician in the sense that we kind of figured out the chord structures we were going with and kind of sent notation and chord sheets off to everybody, and then everyone kind of came together and we'd never all been in the same room at the same time before, half of them I'd never met before, and we started playing and it sounded pretty good, and it was like, oh wow, we're musicians, like we're making music together, and that was exciting to me.
Yeah, and then I mean, when it comes to those kinds of arrangements, like working with people like that, especially early on, I'm sure you, as you go, you become more capable as a producer. I'm sure, sure. As the, you know, but early on, some of your experiences working with producers, I guess they've been kind of all over the map, but you've had very positive experiences working with producers, right?
Yeah, and then, definitely. I mean,
that's like, it can't, it's, many people don't realize how useful a good producer is in
absolutely. Making. Yeah, I mean, like, and there are many different approaches to it, and it, there are many different roles a producer can play. Actually, it's interesting to me right now because I've spent the last year kind of moving into being a producer of other people's music myself. Cool. And I'm in my little studio that I've built here today. And it's quite an instructive experience being on the other side of the glass.
Do you ever like go do something where you just spend an entire day worthless pursuing, and then you're like, now I know why the producer told me never to do that.
Didn't work completely. Yeah. I mean, there have been the occasional moment when I've almost felt bound to call up producers I've worked with in the past and apologize.
I'm so sorry.
I didn't realize how annoying I was being. I think it's a cool learning experience for me. And I think this is what I was going to say. Like, you know, immediately, like, my manager and stuff is asking if I'm going to produce my own stuff going forward. And I think for the time being, the answer is no, because the producer plays an important role in a project. It's not just a guy pressing stop and play on a tape machine or a computer or whatever. Like, there's a kind of referee role that a producer can play. Or I like to say, like, Mr. Miyagi. Do you know what I mean? The producer is like there to kind of like bring something out of you that wouldn't otherwise come out. And I think that's very important.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really something. And you know, one of the things I that struck me reading your second book there, that book I was, let's see, Four Simple Words. That's the name of it, right? The book.
Yeah. Four Simple Words. Yeah.
And also I got to hear the whole thing with you reading it, which was very well delivered.
Oh, right.
Did you work with a producer for that, by the way? I'm just,
there was an engineer kind of telling me what to do. I've done the audio book for both the books I've done. And have you ever done an audio book, recorded an audio book?
Only on my own. But if I were doing it with a producer, or if I had the producer in my head, basically telling me that sounded really stilted, you know, but I listen to a lot of BBC and NPR, so I'm really used to, like, you know, hearing how good delivery happens, you know.
Sure. I mean, and definitely, like, it's kind of like I wanted to do it myself because they're whilst not autobiographies, they are autobiographical, and it would be strange to somebody else to read them. But like, you go in and do your level best, and then it's quite a revealing moment when you then listen to, I don't know, Jeremy Irons or someone reading something, and you kind of go, wow, that dude can read stuff. I find the process to be utterly grueling of recording an audiobook. It's not my favorite thing to do in the world, but you only do it once.
I guess, I mean, recording an album it can be so grueling, but I mean, by the time you finish an album, do you ever just not want to hear any of it? I mean, even though you have to, of course, you know.
Yeah. I tend to not listen to my records for about 5 years after they're finished.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that people kind of appreciate quite how many times you've listened to every single detailed passage of every single thing on the record whilst you're making it.
Yeah.
And when it's done, you're kind of like, cool. Not least because you then, or at least I then tend to go and play those songs live. Do you know what I mean? So they have this other life elsewhere. And I usually, in a way that I think is healthy, I usually tend to hate what I've recorded. Not necessarily songwriting wise, but like I tend to react against it. And I think that's a healthy thing because it's your mind kind of trying to break free from where you were and go to a new place, which is what I think an artist should always try and do. You know, you shouldn't repeat yourself, or at least you should try not to repeat yourself. But I'm always trying to kind of like, I have this kind of thing, and I've been doing this long enough now for this to kind of become regular. About 5 or 6 years after a record has been out, I can listen to it again and go, oh yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's not terrible. Do you know what I mean? Having the intervening half a decade hating it.
Yeah, absolutely. With the whole genre thing, I mean, like you've always been. I mean, basically, you're not interested in genres. And I mean, when I hear your music, I hear music. I hear like you're working with musicians to create great music, and that's what you're doing with every album and every song, really. But the genre question is always this thing that's kind of like I don't know, barking at the heels of the music of musicians anyway. And it's also like something that's very much been created by the music industry over the course of the past century. These genres, which are very rigid, very formulaic, terrible structure,
and indeed pretty politically suspect at certain points.
I mean, I'd say very. It's a blatantly institutionally racist industry in terms of its foundations. You know, only the white people can play rock and roll, and the black people who invented it have to play rhythm and blues, and they have a different audience, and they don't get access. I mean, that's the way it was anyway, and it's
absolutely. Well, that was for a very long period of time. There were race records. That was a thing.
Yeah, race records.
Christ, like it's. I mean, thankfully, whilst we don't remotely live in a perfect world, we at least live in a world in which the term race records is no longer acceptable, and that's progress of a sort.
That's progress.
But the whole thing of genre, I mean, I grew up listening to punk rock records, and it is still, I regard my ethics as based in punk rock. Let's say that. Or at least I like to think that. I mean, there's plenty of people on Twitter who would disagree with that statement, but you know, that's true of Twitter full stop. But like it's like I was saying this to discussing this with a friend the other day. Punk rock has a lot in common with Catholicism. And what I mean by that is that whilst there may be non-Catholics, there's never really an ex-Catholic. If you were once a Catholic, you were always at least on some level consumed by Catholic guilt. And punk rock guilt is a fucking thing. It exists. And, you know, and you lie awake at night and you wonder about what Joe Strummer would think of your decisions. Do you know what I mean?
Like, even folk punk guilt, which is so bizarre because it's such a fairly recent category of music. But, like, you know, there's a folk punk subreddit, you know, and if you, anytime I post something to it that doesn't involve a guitar part that's like, ba 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 ba, you know, if I'm not doing a constant downbeat, you know, and classic punk style guitars, inevitably people might like it, but there's going to be somebody who asks the question, is this folk punk? It's like, who cares? You know?
Yeah, who gives a fuck? I mean, it's funny because, like, when I started my, because I played in punk bands for a long time, when I started my solo career, I wanted to be like Neil Young, essentially, like sort of harvest era Neil Young was what I was going for. And it came out as a sort of, or at least that's a very, very simplified version of it. But it was sort of, you know, I was interested in kind of Nebraska or Springsteen and Neil Young and indeed stuff like George Jones as well, which I'm a huge fan of. But like, and a lot of people said, oh, it's folk punk. And I was almost a little bit like annoyed because I wasn't trying to make it punk. I was just trying to kind of, you know, but it's because I learned to play guitar in a practice room with like everything turned up to 11 and everyone's ears bleeding and stuff. And it just means I play hard and I sing hard. And if that makes it folk punk, well, cool. But like, if somebody turns around and tells me that my last record wasn't folk punk, I'm going to still sleep perfectly well.
You'll sleep well. But what, of course, I think, I mean, when I listen to your music, I would say that the way that people, if people are characterizing it as folk punk, it's because you're well, it's not only your guitar style, but it's also the fact that you're telling stories from a first person perspective that are often related to what we could define as alternative lifestyles, or they sound very punk rock, kind of like sound very punk rock and are narrated from the first person. So I mean, that's like the classic folk punk sort of formula in terms of the lyrics, but in terms of the music, I mean, it, you know, of course it's all over the place. And in terms of lyrics, it's like, well, so what if you're writing from the first person, that makes it folk punk? No, of course, like, you know, I'm often reminded of Springsteen in a lot of some of the recordings you made in the past 10 years in terms
of the, I will take that as a compliment.
I mean, just in terms of the way the band is kind of working to push the music to new heights, and the way the songs are so focused still on like songwriting.
Well, I think that this is something you and I have in common, is a degree of kind of musicological kind of intent. Do you know what I mean? Like, whilst I believe strongly that on a lot of levels that there has to be a kind of instinctive and emotional and unstudied part of making music, nevertheless, I spend a lot of time thinking about it and analyzing it and all the rest of it. And like, I spend a lot of time thinking about the E Street Band specifically, and about how they're essentially the greatest bar band in the history of the world. And I mean, and I use the words bar band as a compliment. Do you know what I mean? Like, I am not a good enough musician to be in a bar band. That is a fact. And you know, the guys in my band are, and like, yeah, there's a certain just kind of raucous, but also kind of adaptive nature to it. Do you know what I mean? It's like you throw anything at it and they're like, cool, we'll run with that and see where it goes. And there's something exciting about it. You know what I mean?
I mean, to me, that sounds absolutely cathartic. I mean, just like the experience of being in a studio with a bunch of amazing musicians and then getting to tell them what to do, and then them trying as hard as they can to do exactly what you just told them to do. It's an amazing experience.
Yeah, you the least qualified musician in the room. You're just kind of like... Yeah, and I mean, so to pick an example, so Matt, who plays piano in my band, is one of the most phenomenal piano players I've ever been anywhere near in my life. And I can sort of just about hammer my way through like a three-finger piano part, you know what I mean? So I'll come up with like a guideline melody for a part and be like, well, it wants to sort of do, do-do-do, and he goes, blah, 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 and I go, yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah, totally. But it's a great privilege to play with those guys, for sure.
And, I don't know how many people are aware of this, but Mark Twain wrote an autobiography, which he only published, I believe it was in 2012, obviously well over a century after his death, which was entirely intentional. I think it was actually exactly, was it exactly? I think the deal was it had to be, they had to wait at least a century into after his death to publish it. I haven't read other than little bits of it, but it's fascinating. It's very long. And, you know, I think anybody who's a songwriter who writes about their lives or people they know can totally appreciate why you'd put out your autobiography 100 years after your death.
Oh, yeah. That's an interesting thing. There is definitely an ethical dilemma somewhere as a songwriter
about that.
Revelation, should we say. Like, in the sense that I've always, my taste has always been for the kind of emotionally raw in music. You know, I enjoy music where people say, like, really revealing and kind of heavy shit. Do you know what I mean? I enjoy that. And therefore, as a writer, you can say revealing and heavy shit about yourself until the fucking cows come home, because it's your life. Knock yourself out. The question becomes, can you say revealing and heavy shit about somebody else's life as it intersects with yours? And what are the rules there? And there is no hard and fast rule, but I find it to be an interesting thing. And particularly, like, my most successful record to date was a breakup record, which was excoriatingly personal. And it was mainly about my failings, because it was a relationship that ended because of my idiocy and my carelessness and all the rest of it. And I thought that was an interesting thing to try and explore creatively. But necessarily, it involved talking reasonably intimately about my relationship with another person, a person who I cared about very much and who I had, of course, recently hurt quite badly. So it was like, shit. Do you know what I mean? Like, am I allowed to do this? Is this the right thing to do? And
we have to change names of people. It doesn't really matter, right?
No, because that person is aware of what's being discussed. And at the bare minimum, your friends will know what's going on. Do you know what I mean? Your mutual friends, whatever. I in the event, I had this terrible thing happen with that. Because, as I say, most of the record was kind of about my bad, should we say. As it should have been, but there's one song on the record called Anymore, which is a kind of a callous song, like deliberately so, and it was, in my view, was sort of one small part of the makeup of the whole story that I was telling. Disastrously enough, she heard that song on its own first before hearing any of the rest of the record, because one of her friends sent it to her without what I regard as the context, and she was deeply upset about that, and that's my fault, and I have to... I mean, I'm pleased to say that we have reached a point of friendship now, and that's a good thing, and she's a wonderful person, and indeed is happily married, and just had her first kid, and I'm very happy about that, I am too. But do you know what I mean? It was just kind of like, when I heard that she'd heard just that song, it was like, no!
So, you can kind of blame the internet for that, though, in a sense, because maybe in the old days, she would have had to buy the record. And maybe listen to the whole thing from, you know.
Exactly. So it's just technology's fault, man.
Yeah. You know, speaking of technology, one of the most entertaining moments in your book was, like, I mean, when you think about a band that's on a label and they're touring, and you think, okay, well, the label is telling you a lot of things that you're supposed to be doing and all this, but when you... I don't know to what degree that's true, but when you decided the first time you'd use pyrotechnics in a show, it was a very it was a very personal decision. And I just found that whole process of reading about, like, how you're deciding to use pyrotechnics. Would you mind telling us about that?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a funny occasion. I mean, essentially, I'd reached a point where I was playing arena shows, and the thing about that, like, I've always tried to stick to the idea that my choice of venues I play should be accommodating to the number of people who want to see me, because I remember being a kid and my favorite bands doing what they call underplays, and I wasn't cool enough to be in the right place in the right time to get a ticket, so I'd never got to see them, and that fucking sucked. And I don't want to present myself in that way, so I reached a point where it made sense to play those kinds of rooms. And when you're playing in a room that large, you have to paint on in broader strokes, because some people are extremely far away from the stage, and sooner or later, your production manager, because production managers tend to be into this shit anyway, brings up pyrotechnics. And the conversation was raised, and we had a song called Broken Piano, which was the final song of the set. And the idea was that, you know, it would be cool to finish off the main set with this dramatic pyrotechnic moment. And I sort of got talked into it. But, you know, I was going along with it. And we got to the first day of the tour. And, of course, the nature of these things is that a fair amount of money has been spent by this point anyway in terms of, like, prepping it. And you have to have a whole extra crew member who's the pyrotechnic safety guy. And he has to press the button. No one else allowed to press the button, all this sort of shit. And in soundcheck of the first show, I decided that I'd made a terrible mistake and that I didn't want to have pyrotechnics in my show. And that wasn't punk or whatever. And my friend Jay Beans on Toast, who is a folk punk singer who plays acoustic guitar and sings and is a wonderful and dear friend of mine, was playing first on. Incidentally, part of the reason he was playing first on was because I felt like it would be a cool way of breaking the ice in terms of my audience seeing me in a room of that size, because Jay is
nice.
He's a human icebreaker. He's just our mate who plays guitar and is brilliant. And it was like, if he's on first, that's really going to set the scene, you know?
Yeah.
I sort of said to my tour manager, I was like, maybe I can just let off the pyrotechnics during Jay's set and, like, not tell him that it's coming and just, like, scare the shit out of him by blowing the stage up halfway through his gig. And was informed that this was incredibly illegal. just, like, absolutely no fucking way are you allowed to do that. So I kind of had rethought. And then I was like, well, okay, fuck it. Let's try it on the first night and see how it feels. And this is the moment where you have to be honest and say it feels fucking great. Like, to stand, if particularly, I might add, if they go off at the right moment, which they don't always. But
timing is important, huh?
Yeah, but to stand on a stage in front of a lot of people is a wonderful thing to be able to do anyway. But to then, I always think of the magician Tim in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the one who just sort of points at shit and it explodes. It's, you know, I was at the moment in the song and the four count came for what I knew would be the drop and the explosion moment and everything. And it was 1, 2, 3, 4. And I kind of, you know, just sort of knocked my guitar headstock down a little bit to emphasize it. And the fucking room exploded and it made me feel very, very strong.
Yes. Yeah.
It was, and we then finished the tour with it. It didn't become a regular part of my show, I have to say, but it was fun for that moment in time.
It didn't become a regular part. Was there a particular reason for that? Is just expensive?
We finished it on that tour. It's quite expensive. You know, I sort of chalked it up as like, I'm glad I did that, but I'm not sure that I need to now turn into Kiss. You know what I mean? Exploding guitars, wires. Actually, funnily enough, one discussion me and my production manager did once have, this was my idea, which he vetoed on the grounds that it was ridiculous, but I thought it'd be amazing. So wires, where you have wires so you can fly around and you have to have a harness and you can have invisible wires. And I was like, I'll have the harness on for the whole show. And all that will happen is in a solo number, I'll just lift off the floor by like 1 inch and then go down again. Oh. And the people in the front row will spend the rest of their fucking lives telling their friends.
I saw Frank Turner levitate.
He fucking flew, man. I saw him, and everyone else will say bullshit. It's not true.
And just don't say anything about it, you know?
Yeah, and just exactly never mention it again.
I had a gig one time at the psychedelic trance tent at Glastonbury, which started at 2 a.m. And my entire audience was tripping on something. Yeah, that was fascinating. I mean, but there was no pyrotechnics involved. By the end of it, I was pretty sure they thought I was floating anyway, so I probably couldn't.
Right. Well, I was about to say, there was no pyrotechnics from where you were standing.
Yeah, from where I was standing.
Yeah. I remember playing like ketamine parties and squats in the past and that kind of thing, and it's a singularly thankless musical endeavor, like a room full of zombies.
Yeah, it really depends on what they're tripping on. I mean, at that particular gig, there were some ready to start a cult with me as the guru and others left at the beginning. You know, it was like, it was very depending, you know, on what they were up for, you know.
Well, you provoked a reaction, which is better than
I definitely provoked several reactions. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I don't know if this is a weird thing to say, like who might think this is a weird thing, because I think, you know, whether you're a musician or you're not a musician, I think a lot of people are aspiring to be basically in your position in life, Frank. But, you know, when the last time I saw you in, and you had a show in Portland, which was an amazing show. And then, At the end of the night, you know, after we hung out at a nearby pub, you and the whole band are getting in the tour bus and then sleeping in the bus and going to the next gig. And that's the standard procedure. And this is how it is for what we call successful bands all over the world. And, you know, of course, this is success, right? In so many ways, you're playing for thousands of people. You're making a good living. But like, I mean, and but for those, I don't know. I would wonder if you miss the days when you were driving around in a car and playing for low hundreds, you know.
Oh yeah. I mean,
personally, my favorite audience to play for is 400 people in a theater. Not that I ever get to, you know, choose what size my audience is necessarily. I'll take what I can get, but that's sure. Amazing. You know, but the bigger audiences are more difficult in a way, are they? Or do, yeah, or do you just like them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's, I mean, and again, this is a thing where I feel like there is a slightly kind of like studious part of my character. And I spend a lot of time when I reached a point where I was able to play to larger audiences. I mean, again, I want to play to whoever wants to see me play. I'm an entertainer at heart, and that's a thing that I'm proud to call myself. But that. Like, yeah. You know, I have seen large shows as an audience member in large spaces where the band really hasn't connected with the back row, as they say, or whatever. And I've seen shows where people have, and actually he's come up again, but like I've seen Springsteen connect with 60,000 people at the same time. And it raises the question, well, what, how precisely do you do that? And it's a strange thing because not that many people get an opportunity to try. I'm very fortunate to have had that. And it's not really for me to talk about how successful or not I may be at doing it. But certainly a thing I think about quite a lot. It's like, you know, I remember standing at the back of Hyde Park watching Springsteen and feeling very, very emotionally involved in what he was doing. And the question is, well, how's he doing that? You know, and is it technical or is it instinctive, or do you know what I mean? And
yeah,
in terms of missing
how that works, by the way, I
think there are technical sides to it. I mean, one of the things, this is what I'm talking about. One of the things I learned, I was talking about painting in broad strokes earlier. When you're playing a large room, you have to talk more slowly. Yep. In between songs on stage, because your voice booms around the room and you can't just kind of natter away conversationally on stage. You have to slow down what you're saying in such a way that it still feels natural, but somebody a long way away is still going to understand what you're saying. And that's a kind of a little kind of thing that you learn how to do. But at the same time, I mean, well, I think actually one of the things for me, which was kind of telling, is when I had my first arena headline show at Wembley Arena in 2012. And in the run up to it, I kind of had this sort of tizzy of deciding that I needed to completely remodel everything I was doing because now I was playing an arena show. And I suddenly had a moment of saying to myself, well, hold on, no, because the reason I got here is because of what I do and the way that I do it. And maybe there's some minor things to tweak, but almost in a way, the thing that I think makes those things translate is to not treat it as anything different. Do you know what I mean? If you don't walk on stage and act like you're a fucking quote unquote rock star, then you won't come across as one. Do you know what I mean? Yep. And like, if you just try and remain conversational, then it will translate better. That's been my experience of it. But as I say, it's not really for me to say whether or not I've succeeded at doing this anyway.
That's not entirely true, is it? Because sometimes you can often tell, right? I mean, you say something and you just, by the way, you just delivered a line, whether you're speaking or singing, there's an immediate reaction, sure. Which is a wonderful thing about live performance for an audience, right? You don't, like, who cares what the critics say, but what your audience thinks, you actually have a lot of immediate feedback from them, right?
I had a very distinctive moment, actually. I was touring on my second record, and it was a very exciting time for me. It was the thing where, like, literally every show we put on sale just sold out straight away. So we bump it up, and it would sell out again, and it was like, fuck. We came to, and this, at the start of that record, I was playing to 100 people a night, and by the end of it, we were playing to 2,000 people a night, and that was a very exciting moment in my life. And we were touring, and we got to Nottingham, and we'd been booked into the small room at Rock City, which holds 400 people, and they bumped us up to the big room, which holds 1,800 people. But you can close the balcony, and it then holds 1,000 people, and that was the deal. We were just going to do the downstairs, and I was like, well, 1,000 people, that's insane, but cool. And then we got there, and the guys who run Rock City are old friends of mine, and they were like, oh, we're sold out tonight. And I said, wow, 1,000 tickets, that's amazing. I said, no. You're sold out 1,800 tickets. The whole fucking room's gone. And I remember kind of going,
whoa,
off, no, like, you're kidding me. And then what I remember is there was a moment in the set in a song called Love Iron Song where I would kind of drag this penultimate note of the song out for a while. Well, and I do it with my eyes closed, my hand up like this. And then I go, well, like that. And it was a habit I got into, and fucking 1,800 people sung the note with me and stopped when I did that. And I kind of looked at my hand and was like, like, the power.
Yeah. The power. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And all those, the smallest motions get so amplified, right?
Right. That in, yeah. And there's funny because this now, we're now straight into the territory of talking about responsibility of a performer. And instinctively, on some levels, I don't really accept the idea that you have a responsibility as a performer, because I think that the one responsibility you have as an artist is to be true to your art, and everything else.
But not responsibility, but what you, but the amplification effect is there, regardless of whether you have a particular responsibility or what. But and you've had a lot of, I mean, I think anybody in anybody who's an artist really ends up having these kinds of experiences on a regular basis, depending on their how prominent they are and whether they dabble in writing anything about politics. And I mean, you've had, I'd say, far more than your fair share of these kinds of experiences. Of this application. I mean, recently I was accused for the nth time of, you know, because of my criticisms of the state of Israel, I was accused once again of being an anti-Semite, which is a regular thing. And it's a terrible accusation to make for anybody who just has a lot of criticisms of governments and stuff like that. And as a person of Jewish lineage, it's easier to take these kinds of accusations, but I deal with that regularly, and I'm not even that famous. And I was complaining on a text to Tom Morello about this, and he said, "Yeah, that, getting accused of these things, that sounds like an average Tuesday to me, you know." And
yeah, sure.
This is basically, then you were saying about how you basically, I mean, I don't know if you tend to avoid a lot of feedback, as we might call it, that you get on social media for sanity's sake. Yeah,
well, on social media is the important point there. That's the important part of that sentence.
I mean, social media.
Yeah, right. But I mean, I guess my point is, like, in terms of like public kerfuffles that I've been involved in, there are certain caveats that have to be put in place. One of which is that you cannot spend your life trying to alert the world to your existence and then complain when not everybody loves you. That's ridiculous. Secondly, I've said some dumb shit. Everybody has. But the point is, as you're saying, with the amplification effect, and indeed the whole nothing ever dies on the internet effect as well, and to a degree, I have to take my oil about it. Like, and I can, I mean, the unfortunate thing is that in the world of social media, things like forgiveness and doubt are in short supply. And that's, in my opinion, disastrous for everybody. But nevertheless, you know, on some levels, yeah, fine. I'll throw my hands up and I'll take my oil for having said insensitive or dumb shit at certain points and blah, blah, blah. It is important to me philosophically to be contactable, to be accessible, to be part of a conversation with my audience and not be removed from my audience. To me, the most important thing that punk rock ever meant was the idea that the musicians and the audience are the same. And so on that level, my email address is on my website and anyone can contact me. And this is the interesting and important point, is that when people contact me, and sometimes people who don't like me contact me, but in that format where it's a conversation between two humans, they behave in kind of normal ways and you can have an exchange of views that doesn't become ridiculous straight away. And it's human. The point about social media is it's a performative medium. 90% of the time when somebody sends you like a sort of some kind of hatred on there, it's, you're not even the primary audience for what they're doing. Do you know what I mean? It's for everyone else to demonstrate that they're having a go at you. Check me out. I'm doing this. And you're almost like a bit part in the conversation in which you are in theory, like one of the principal players. And it's a very strange thing. And I think it's destructive in extreme ways for us as a species. And I mean, I can talk about this till the cows come home. I mean, one of the things for me is that, like, as a species, we have evolved social cues when we talk to other people, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Twitter in particular strips that away. And therefore people talk to other humans on Twitter like they're not talking to other humans, like they're screaming into a fucking hole in the ground or whatever. And they, most of the time, I mean, not that I do this anymore, but if you respond, a lot of people go, "Oh, wow, I never thought you'd read it." And you're like, but you said it to me. Like, what the fuck? But and you sort of therefore understand it's doing something, it's short-circuiting our communication skills in a way that I think is terrible for everybody. And at the risk of sounding like an old and arguably patronizing old fart, like, I worry for younger people, because I was fortunate enough to at least kind of establish myself in some ways intellectually before all of this landed in the world. And for kids who've grown up where that is their central engagement with the world, I worry. And I used to say people talk to each other on Twitter like they'd never do in real life, but that's not even true anymore, because some people have learned to communicate in that way and therefore will communicate in that way to other humans. And it's awful, and maybe it makes me kind of a dreary kind of aging centrist liberal, blah, 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 blah. But like, I think there's a place for civility in most of our conversations. Not all. I don't wish to be civil to the fucking Proud Boys or whatever. But nevertheless, that, you know, the idea of an exchange of views, the idea of self-doubt, the idea of challenging your own positions in life is very important to me. And that, all of that is just foreign to much of the world that we live in now. And I think that's really worrying to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's, to me, it's so distressing because, like, I mean, even, you know, it's not that people who are well known deserve more or less respect than anybody else, but it's one of these things that you see, like, any prominent, especially female artist or journalist, the amount of horrible abuse, horrible sexist abuse that they get on Twitter is just, it's so depressing because it just makes me think, like, well, so there's no other than maybe, you know. I mean, you get your fans, it'll be a good life, but you know, your relationship to this sort of public sphere on Twitter is so toxic because there's these people out there and they're going to say this stuff and no matter what, right?
I think the other thing is that there is an amplification effect that takes place psychologically. For me, at any rate, I had a thing of a couple of years ago where I was on the receiving end of a fair amount of abuse on Twitter that day for whatever reason it was. And it was really getting me down. And it does. And it's important to say that it affects my mental health and my anxiety levels in disastrous ways for me personally. And that night I happened to be playing a show in Lancaster Town Hall to 2,000 people. It was a benefit show for the local food bank, which my sister happened to run. And I was like, I hadn't slept the night before and I was kind of wasn't eating and I was in a really shitty place. And my wife said to me, she was like, the number of people having a go at you right now on the internet would not even fill the front row of this room. Right. And yet here you are losing your fucking mind about this. And it's, and you know, you and I both, we know this. You can scroll through 100 people telling you that you're a genius and then one person calls you an asshole. And that's the only thing you're going to think about for the rest of your week.
Why is that? But it's so true. And then you do the calculations and you realize, okay, there's these people shouting, but I'm not losing any record sales. I'm not losing any audience on Spotify. I'm not like fewer people are coming to my shows. It's like, who are these people? You can rationalize it, but still.
Yeah, and well, then sooner or later, you have to ask. For me, this has been a useful kind of psychological tool or like method, should we say, is to like, is there anything that I could do that would placate these people? Like, what action could I take that would actually make them go, oh, actually, you know what? You're cool. You're on side. And in not every case, but in a lot of cases, there is no answer to that question. At which point, why bother? Why spend any time engaging? Like, you know, I'm not a perfect human being, Jesus Christ, but it's like, I don't need to waste my time trying to please people whose sole and only wish to engage with me is to criticize and attack. Mm-hmm. And almost it's like, if you cease to provide things for them to criticize and attack, they then lose interest in you. And it's kind of like, so why bother? Like,
stop engaging, huh? I love the way your attitude is. You're there as both an entertainer and basically, and I hear this in so many of your songs, but especially in the Be Kind, Be More Kind. And there's a lot of other songs where I'm hearing a lot of messages like this, where you're basically a cheerleader for people in the world, for your fans, for your friends, for your family, for whoever's listening. I mean, you're just giving this wonderful sort of very universal kind of, advice and empathy that's just, just the right kind of message rather than, you know, getting bogged down and arguing with stupid people. Right?
Well, yeah, totally. And are you familiar with the writer Clive James?
No. I don't think so.
Clive James was an Australian literary critic and poet and essayist who spent his adult life in London and sadly died a year and a half ago. He passed away. But he spent the last about 6 years before he died, he was given 6 months to live and then outlived his diagnosis considerably, which was both wonderful for him as a person. But also he wrote a whole series of poems about mortality in that phase of his life, which, I mean, he was kind of my favorite writer anyway, but the work he did at the end of his life is just fucking believable to me. And the title of that song comes from, he has a poem called Les Sons des Ténèbres. And at the beginning of it, he says, I should have been more kind. It is my fate to find this out, but find it out too late. And I just remember thinking to myself, if somebody who I regard as being one of the wisest humans I've ever encountered, not that we ever met, but you know, whose work I've ever encountered. If his view at the moment of the end of his long and storied life is to just say the one thing he wishes he would have done differently would to be more kind, it's like, well, if that's good advice, then, I mean, I'm going to take it. Let's try and fucking take that advice. You know what I mean? So I stole the line from my song because, you know, that's what we do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, listening to the album where you got that song 1933 on it, and Make America Great Again, but this 1933, I mean, it's a brilliant song, and the way it's coming from first person, but you're also at the same time as you're talking about your emotional state with the rise of the far right, you're going out to a bar to deal with that emotional state and commenting on history and the present, and you do this all within 3 minutes, and I think that's it's a real achievement to be able to do all that so well. And it's like it has emotional personal content as well as like a whole bunch of history that you managed to slip in there that, you know, people could just look that up. And that's what's so great about writing history, any song with even a reference to history. It doesn't even need to be about something, but then now it's so easy to do the research, so people
I mean, I'm a big history nerd in my life.
You have a degree in history, in fact, from London School of Economics. And why did you get a degree in history from the London School of Economics? Did you study economics too?
Passingly, yes. I mean, and in fact, later in life, I've become a bit of an economics nerd as well. Although in an extremely amateur fashion, it's important to say at this point. But I ended up there. I initially got a place there to study sociology. I mean, they don't just do economics there; they are a kind of social sciences school. And in my first term there, this was such a long time ago, in my first term there, the sociology lectures weren't quite grabbing me, and I ended up kind of sneaking in some of the history lectures. And in particular, there was a woman called Anita Prasmowska, who was a professor there, who became my tutor, who was a Polish. She'd actually defected from Poland in the 1970s as an intellectual, and was now teaching at the LSE. And under her aegis, I switched to doing history, and I studied Central and Eastern European history in the 19th and 20th centuries. Briefly, there's a wonderful story about her. So by time university finished, I was touring in this band Million Dead that I used to be in, and I kind of started missing quite a lot of uni because I would be in Belgium on tour or whatever it was. And I got my degree, and I got a good degree, and she said to me, now is the time for you to stop this music nonsense and come and study for your doctorate with me. And I said to her, look, I'm not going to do that right now, because I was in a band that was starting to do quite well and everything was very exciting. So, you know, I was just like, eh. And then the next thing was it was 12 years later, the night before I was due to play at the O2 Arena, which is the largest indoor venue in London. It's like 14,000 capacity, and I was headlining there. And she came up in conversation with an old friend of mine, and we've been close, you know. And the thing is, like, finding the email addresses of academics at university is quite easy. It's usually first name dot last name at the university. So after a couple of glasses of wine, I fired her an email just saying, hey, I'm still doing that stupid music thing, and tomorrow night I'm playing the O2. And I said, you know, I can, if you want to come, I can sort like a box, you know, with like, I can put some champagne on ice and blah, 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 and all this kind of thing. And she replied and said, I'm still not interested in your stupid music.
Oh, wow. You got to have respect for that.
I know. Wow. It was amazing. Jeez. But then a couple of days later, and I think she sort of was worried she'd been a bit harsh, she messaged me and said she'd recently finished writing a book about Władysław Gomułka, who was a reform era communist, who I wrote a song about when I was in Million Dead because I was trying to show off my intellectual bona fides. And she'd recently finished a new biography of Gomułka, and she had a book launch, and she invited me to the book launch, and I went, and we had a cup of coffee, and it was lovely.
That is so. That's so nice. Then you went to the book launch on her terms, and
exactly. And she still didn't come.
And she didn't want to come, even with the champagne.
I know, unbelievable.
That's really quite something. You know, Frank, you. I mean, it just so happens that the trajectory of your career coincides with the collapse of the music industry globally. I mean, basically, when did Million Dead start touring? When was that?
We started touring in 2001, 2002, somewhere around there.
Yeah. So the music, started touring when the music industry had already begun collapsing 4 years previously. But when CDs were still being purchased, you know, to a large extent for a while, right? And then, but then it continued its decline till about 2017. It was about 20% the size of what it was in 1997. And then at the same time, in the course of your career, you've been mostly living in London when you're not on tour, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. London has undergone the most unbelievable process of gentrification of just about any city in the world over the past 20 years, with the exception of New York, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, yeah, and a lot of other places. And I'm just wondering, what has that whole experience? I mean, you, when you were getting started, you know, as a musician, you were very familiar with a lot of the smaller clubs and cafes around London, what we could call the underground scene. Many of those places have closed since then. I mean, what just, I this is very vague, broad, but what, sure, what are your experiences of these things?
I mean, well, first of all, as far as the music industry goes, like, I mean, in some ways, like, I didn't really have masses of experience of it prior to Collapse to Mourn. Do you know what I mean? Like, no. I mean, it was already kind of like everyone running around with their trousers on fire by the time
I started doing stuff. By the time you started, right.
Yeah. So there's that. And then secondly, like, I mean, I think it's really important to say that I care about music much more than I care about industry or business. And, you know, in many ways, the last 20 years has been a time of great anarchy in the music industry in a way that I'm kind of interested in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at the career of stuff like the Arctic Monkeys or whatever, who kind of like just smashed through the structures by just doing their own thing, and it felt very kind of punk to me in a cool way, you know. And but ultimately, I mean, I can, speaking from personal experience, like, there's been enough of an industry there to facilitate me making my music and having a career from it. And certainly I don't have any figures on this, but what I would say is that it seems obvious to me that the live side of things has grown in that period of time. Certainly I remember being a kid and like, I remember, like, Rage Against the Machine played the Astoria. They were, like, the biggest band in the country, and they played to 2,000 people. If Rage Against the Machine were at their peak, wow, in England now, they would play Hyde Park. I mean, they play fucking arenas, stadiums, whatever. But, and maybe that was an underplay, but, like, and even just, I remember the gigs pages in the back of Kerrang. There was, like, two pages of gigs for the whole country for a week, you know. And now that would be very different. Or, I mean, obviously not right now because of obvious recent events. But, like, certainly I feel like, when I was a teenager starting to get into live music, going to gigs was a much more niche activity than it is now. I think that a much broader spectrum of people regard live music of one kind or another as being part of their kind of culture diet, should we say. And I think that's cool. So, and I mean, I'm fortunate in that as a kid, my idols were Black Flag, and that remains largely true. And one of the things I idolized was their kind of dedication to the road and their endless, ceaseless, grinding, grueling touring. And I always wanted that, you know, and it turned out that that was the one kind of growth area of the music industry as I've gone through it. And I've been fortunate in that. And I've made my living on the road. I don't make money out of record sales, really, or at least not an amount that sort of troubles my calculations, should we say.
No, troubles your calculations. Yeah. And what about, I mean, the whole streaming reality is, I mean, no, you know, it's such an obtuse sort of, I mean, there's no, all the calculations are very intentionally secretive and in terms of how the whole thing works. But
yeah.
What are your impressions of the new music industry and streaming?
I think it's interesting. I mean, I try my best to be suspicious of nostalgia as a driving force, generally speaking, because I think that there's something slightly kind of backward looking about it.
And, even though you write some fucking great nostalgia songs.
Oh yeah, sure, of course. I'll indulge when I'm got a guitar.
It's an emotion you are expert on.
But I guess what I mean by that is, like, I have a lot of friends who kind of talk about the days when you had to, like, really search for music and then you'd have to pay money and it would make you value it more. And I kind of get what they're talking about. But at the same time, the example I always think of is, I remember when I was a kid and I was first getting into hardcore, somebody told me about the Cro-Mags, right? And they're like, if you like hardcore, you should listen to the Cro-Mags. In 1996 or whenever this was, there was no fucking way of getting a Cro-Mags record in the UK. It just was not an option unless you knew someone who had it already who would tape it for you or whatever. And I remember it took me like 2.5 years to get a copy of Age of Quarrel. It's a great record. But Now,
it wasn't worth the wait, though. I would have liked to get it sooner. Yeah.
Holly Flanagan would probably beat me up if I answered that question, honestly. But but now, anyone who's watching this, who's not heard the Chromax, can listen to Age of Coral before I finish the sentence. You know what I mean? And there's that's good. That's a positive thing. And like, there was, again, people get nostalgic for the kind of like the more kind of underground tribal nature of certain things. And certainly when I was a kid, there was punk kids and there was metal kids and there was rave kids. And those barriers have kind of like fallen down to a degree. But I'm not sure I see that as a problem. And like, you know, if kids these days are much more omnivorous in their music taste, well, that's fucking great. Isn't that good? You know, and like, kids can sort of pick and choose. Also, I mean, there were bottlenecks and there were gatekeepers in the old music industry. I remember like the Strokes, who I like as a band, but like there was a moment when it was just kind of announced that they were going to be the biggest band in the world, and then the following week they were, and it had just been sort of agreed by about seven people, and therefore it happened. And back then, music journalists could write an article about how guitar music is dying. And it would mean something, because what it meant in practice was that guitar music was being choked off at certain points by people who weren't into it anymore. Nowadays, if somebody says ska is dead or whatever, grindcore doesn't matter anymore. I mean, I'm riffing here, but like, it doesn't matter because you can just go and listen to it anyway. No one can stop you listening to it. And that's great. Do you know what I mean? There's something, and this is what I mean about it's kind of decentralized now. And I think that there's a kind of weird nostalgia for a point in time when the music industry was much more kind of authoritarian, for want of a less charged word. And nowadays, it's pretty fucking easy to get your music on Spotify. You might not get paid much for it, but at the same time, like, the barriers to entry, and this is also true of recording technology and all the rest of it, the barriers to entry have been kind of annihilated. And I think that's exciting. You know, and then if I may be so idiotic as to like make some predictions kind of thing, one of the things I'm thinking about quite a lot right now is that like COVID and everything that's happened last year has kind of at the very least left most of the music industry kind of punch drunk. And I think that there's an opportunity for some exciting things to happen right about now. Even if it's just the fact that I might well spend quite a lot of the rest of this year just like playing shows on a fucking standing on a beer crate in the corner of a pub, because that's the only place I can figure out that's allowed or whatever. And then using social media in the way that it can be positive, of just kind of going, hey, I'm going to be in fucking Bradford tonight. I'll see you there. And it might be quite exciting. Do you know what I mean? Rather than like having a 3-month lead in and a pre-sale and a blah, 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 and all this shit on a tour, it might be much more just like, bam, there's a fucking show. And I think that's cool. And despite the fact that over my career, I have engaged with the kind of more overarching structures of a bigger career and all this kind of thing, I'm attracted to the bits where people have no fucking idea what's going on.
Yeah, and really, I think you've done such a great job just now of describing all the positive aspects of this whole situation, of which there are so many, right? And then you've one thing I think all of us have found pretty much who are, you know, able to get online is that the pandemic has made that whole connection. If you don't have that kind of connection with a group of people in a room, but you have this much more international connection with just random people all over the world.
Absolutely.
You've had that experience.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, with the weekly shows I was doing, the benefit shows I was doing for music venues, it was interesting at the beginning. Like, a lot of people tuned in because I was one of the first people to start regularly live streaming. And over time, the audience kind of winnowed down, which I was expecting. And actually, it took longer to do that than I had thought it would, which was nice. But by sort of the end of it, and we're talking like nearly a year after I started, it got down to a core of about 2,500 people who would come every week, who were from all over the world. And I got the last one that I did, because I have kind of hung up my hat on them for the time being in hope of them not being necessary for too much longer. But like, the last one was kind of emotional, because every week we'd have the chat going. And my wife was kind of saying, you know, I wish we could get this group of people, just this group of people in a room for one show. It's never going to fucking happen, because there's Australians and Germans and Canadians and whatever else. But like, there was a sense of connection there, and it was a sats in many ways, but like, it was certainly better than anything else that was going on in terms of connection at that moment in time. And people,
the idea.
They, Yeah, people say they found their friends psychologically useful. I found them psychologically useful. It gave me something to fucking do. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's a wonderful core group of 2,500 people from all over the world every week. That sounds actually pretty amazing. Although I can see how, you know, eventually anything can get old and when you're not performing.
I ran out of songs. That's the truth. I played my entire catalog and I played quite a lot of covers that I know. And then it just reached a point where it was like, unless I start working through Weezer records from like from the beginning to the end,
it's the same audience every week. So what are you going to do? Yeah, you can't just play different set every week.
That's the thing. When you're on tour, you can play the same set night after night because it's different people, right?
I don't know what the connection is here, but I'm reminded of John Otway, who had an idea to do a tour around the world in a commercial airliner that he would rent he needed to get 300 people to all, you know, like pitch in to rent an airliner so they could do a world tour, but he'd be performing for the same group of 300 people every time.
Yeah, amazing. John is something. I had the fortune of playing a few shows with John right when I started out, and he is an absolute diamond of a human.
He's a genius. Yeah,
he's amazing.
Frank, it's been such a pleasure talking with you.
I feel like we could do this more.
I would love to. And yeah, we didn't get to, I have a whole bunch more questions we didn't get to. We'll have to talk again sometime.
We should do that. We should do that. I should warn you that this evening I am on cooking duty.
Oh, good.
Means that
time to go make dinner then.
I have to make dinner at some point. But this has been an absolute burst. And you know, who knows when it will be permitted for us to cross the pond and all that kind of thing again. But I sincerely hope that we will share a beer in a bar at some point.
I hope so too. Somewhere over there, over here, or somewhere. Or see you again online. Either way, depending on the variants and how they're spreading.
And we're all amateur.
We are all amateur epidemiol. I still can't say the word, but I'm an amateur one. <yeah. laughs> I lost 2 teeth and I can no longer say epidemiol. No, forget it. Take care, Frank.
What a pleasure. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for joining in on this discussion with Frank Turner. You can find this archived in audio form if you look for This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts. All right. And I'll be doing a concert tomorrow right here online at 1 p.m. Yeah, Saturday, right? Saturday, 1 p.m., last Saturday of every month, 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. GMT. I'll be right here again doing a little concert. All right. Bye for now. Remember, trust your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. And don't pay the rent unless you really have to. Bye for now.